I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Later in the program, my conversation with Monique. We'll talk about her new late-night talk show and why she says she took on her most provocative film role yet in the film Precious. And we'll talk about Lou Dobbs. The controversial CNN anchor has decided to step down. We'll try to learn more. That's all later in the program. But first, we return to the tragedy at Fort Hood last week, and we examine an issue that has arisen in the wake of the shooting that left 13 people dead and more than 40 wounded. The question is this: did colleagues and associates of Major Nidal Hassan, the Army psychiatrist accused in the shooting, fail to raise warning flags about him because of concerns about being, quote, politically incorrect, which is to say because of fears that raising concerns would be seen as prejudiced or insensitive to Muslims? Conversely, did fellow Muslims with whom he associated and worshipped fail to raise warning signs about him because of their fear about being seen as causing dissension or disharmony in their community? We'll examine both sides of the sensitive question with a number of people who have been thinking about it and writing about it over the past few days. First, though, we want to talk about just what some of those warning signs were. Washington Post reporter Dana Priest wrote a piece for the paper earlier this week about a PowerPoint presentation Major Hassan gave as a senior psychiatry resident at Walter Reed Army Hospital when he was posted there. Dana, welcome. Thank you for joining us.
Nice to be here, Michelle.
What was this PowerPoint presentation and what was in it that has caused some concern in retrospect?
Well, he was a fourth-year resident, and during that year, all residents are supposed to give a medical presentation to all of the physicians that they work with. And instead of giving a medical presentation, he decided to write about the Quranic worldview and the implications for the U.S. military. So he is first giving some history about the Quran, explaining some things, but you see soon that his version of the Quran's worldview is very much a radical extremist version in which people cannot live in harmony, in which believers are okayed to fight against non-believers, and that there is a inherent conflict among Muslims themselves over fighting in a war that involves other Muslims. Well, first of all, he admonished the army to identify these people and then to figure out a way to resolve their conflict, which he gave as a recommendation, allowing them to leave the service as conscientious objectors. The question that you raise as about political correctness is really spot on, because the people who heard this, from what I know, is that some of them didn't know how to approach him about it for that very reason, that they felt that touching on the subject, even talking about Islam with Muslims, would be somehow politically incorrect, and certainly questioning or criticizing even the extremist version that he was giving would not be acceptable. And so that issue, I think, really is at the crux of why the Army and his colleagues didn't say to him in a more in-depth way, you know, what is your thought? What is going on? And furthermore, I think that it really points to the fact that the people in the Army are so unaware of what Islam really is that they're not even sure how to ask the question.
Well, that was going to be my next question. Do you, in your reporting, those who spoke with you, do they recall being uncomfortable at the time? And were they uncomfortable at the time because they did not agree with his findings or because they thought it was just outside of the scope of the presentation? Because I must say, when I read the report, it occurred to me that some of the things he was saying are the same things that have been said by some conservative pundits.
Yeah.
Who suggests that there is a dissonance for some observers, for some, and therefore that dissonance between the military mission, the current mission, and their beliefs may cause anxiety and has to be reconciled. Can you identify what is it that you think caused these people distress at the time?
Well, I haven't talked to enough of the people that sat in the room to be certain of this. What I do know is that the supervisors were unhappy because of the nature of the presentation. Now, whether or not they caught on to the extremist views that were in there, that I'm not sure about. And the people that I did speak to who themselves were there said they certainly felt uncomfortable. They thought it was really weird. It's not that they linked those feelings with him in particular, but they thought it was really strange that he was taking that view. And the other thing is, once the presentation was you know, we put it on our website. There are other Muslim soldiers there who they spend a lot of time asking a very honest, you know, upfront, what does this mean? What does that mean? And really, it again points to this issue of not even having the basic understanding of the religion to know even how to address issues that might make you feel uncomfortable. And in that sense, it's like any other discussion between a minority and a majority groups. If you don't know how to begin it, you know, you're likely not even to start because you might make a mistake and make a fool of yourself.
Dana Priest is a Pulitzer Prize winning reporter who writes for The Washington Post. If you want to read the piece that we've just been talking about, we'll have a link on our website. Just go to npr.org, click on programs, and then on Tell Me More. Dana Priest joined us from her home office. Dana, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you, Michelle.
Now we go to Tom Ricks. He is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and author of several best-selling books about the military. He writes the Best Defense blog at foreignpolicy.com. This week he wrote a post called Five Questions About the Fort Hood Shooting. Tom, thanks for joining us.
You're welcome.
Tom, all of these questions have become actually more relevant in the wake of new reporting. For example, NPR's Daniel Zwerdling reported yesterday that Major Hassan's supervisors were very concerned about his performance and even discussed whether he might be psychotic, but that they thought the bureaucratic process for trying to get rid of him was too complex. So I want to go to the first question you ask in your blog. You say that the shooter was a low performer. Why was he shuffled along instead of simply being let go? And then the second question you ask is, was he not let go for fear of appearing prejudiced? So I want to ask about the two of those things together. Is that, do you find that to be common in your reporting on the military, that people who are not strong performers, there's for some reason that there's no willingness to actually address it squarely, regardless of ethnicity or the circumstance?
Yeah, on the first issue, just low performers, there is a famous little dirty trick in the military of dumping your low performers on other units, getting rid of them. And there are certain places you find these guys just wash up. This especially sent off my alarm bells when I read that the shooter was down in Fort Hood, basically in a paperwork job. It sounded to me like somebody had said, look, this guy should not be actually counseling soldiers. He's a nut. So just have him fill out paperwork somewhere.
And then the second question is, was he not let go for fear of appearing prejudiced? Why do you ask that?
Because this wasn't just your average Muslim soldier. There are a lot of great Muslim soldiers in the U.S. military. We want them there. We need them there. They're good. Diversity is a strength of the Army especially. What you don't want is crazy Muslim terrorist wearing the uniform of the U.S. Army. And that's what seemed to happen here. There were a lot of signals here. The great reporting that Zwerdling has done, that Dana Priest has done, is showing there were warning signs, at least, at Walter Reed. Then you have the fact that this guy is playing footsie with an Islamic extremist advocate of terrorism, a radical cleric living in Yemen.
Well, I don't know that his supervisors at Walter Reed would have been in a specific position to know that.
No, so, not at all.
But here's the question I have for you is, why do you think it's fear of appearing prejudiced as opposed to that he had an in-demand skill set or profile? I mean, for example, you and I have worked in some newsrooms where we've encountered some very obnoxious people. And is it that people are afraid of offending them or that they are perceived to be so in demand that people are on eggshells around them?
Are obnoxious. You and I could probably think of a couple. It's because I've gotten notes from people in the military who said, look, you try to get rid of this guy and it turns into another Chaplain Yee situation. It's egg on our face. You guys in the media would all write stories saying Muslim psychiatrist fired for practicing while being Muslim. And I think there is a fear. The military is a large conformist organization. They don't like to have the flashlight turned in their direction, especially in rare areas, you know, like support areas. They're more comfortable with having the media at the front lines of combat. But getting into their personnel issues and decisions makes them extremely uneasy.
Finally, Tom, you say that if Army officers are worried about a backlash against Muslim troops, the best way to address it would be to reassure soldiers that the Army is uncovering and dismissing Muslim extremists who veer into extremism. We only have about a minute and a half left, and I apologize because it's a complex question, but can they do that while respecting different perspectives? Because the fact is, our soldiers still do have First Amendment rights. They do have the right to have beliefs that might be uncomfortable for some.
Oh, absolutely. The Army is actually pretty good at doing this in the enlisted ranks. I've seen officers, you know, speak to soldiers, you know, get that Nazi crap off your wall. You cannot have a swastika up on your wall. We don't tolerate that kind of behavior, that kind of talk in the U.S. military. Where the Army is less good is in policing the ranks of officers, and especially in specialized things like chaplains or medical people, doctors and psychiatrists. And I think that's where they were blindsided here. They're not accustomed to looking. But I think it would reassure other soldiers that the Army was not asleep at the wheel, as it seems to have been in this case.
Do you have any other questions after the five questions that you ask? And for those who want to read your whole piece, we'll certainly have a link on our website. Any other questions that you have in the wake of now of what you've now learned? I guess the question I have for you, do you think it's ethnicity and religion, or do you think it's really more about rank?
I think it's more fear. It's the Army's fear of getting slammed for looking prejudiced, I think, that really may have been the basic problem here.
Tom Ricks writes the Best Defense blog for foreignpolicy.com. He's the author most recently of The Gamble, General Petraeus and the American Military Adventure in Iraq, 2006 to 2008. Before that, the best-selling Fiasco, the American Military Adventure in Iraq. He joined us from his home office. Thank you, Tom.
You're welcome.
We want to mention, if you want to read more of NPR's coverage of the aftermath of the Fort Hood shooting incident, especially correspondent Daniel Zwerdling's reports that we were just talking about, please go to our website at npr.org. I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. We're going to continue to discuss the shooting at Fort Hood. We're talking about whether so-called political correctness prevented colleagues and associates of Major Ndal Hassan, the Army psychiatrist accused of last week's shooting rampage, from aggressively pursuing concerns about Hassan's own mental health and fitness for duty. A few minutes ago, we heard from two reporters who cover the military who discussed warning flags that arose and how the military responded to them. Now we want to discuss another side of that story, whether Hassan's associates within the Muslim community ignored or downplayed possible warning signs of his instability. We've called upon Imam Jahari Abdul Malik. He's the director of outreach at the Dar al-Hijra Islamic Center in Falls Church, Virginia, where Ndal Hassan sometimes attended services. Also with us is journalist Asra Nomani, who wrote an article for the Daily Beast called Inside the Gunman's Mosque. She talked to Muslim congregants at a Muslim center in Silver Spring, Maryland, where Hassan also spent some time. Welcome to you both. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Michelle.
Alhamdulillah, good to be here.
Asra, I'm going to start with you. You met with a local Bangladeshi-American civil engineer who knew Ndal Hassan and had conversations with him about his beliefs in Islam. And the man you met told you that he always had a feeling that Hassan was extremist and could one day become harmful. But why didn't he speak up?
You know, he spoke up to Major Hassan, and he spoke up in the mosque. He said that he didn't know that Major Hassan was in the army. Otherwise, if he had, he would have sent out a, you know, warning shot to the military also. But in our communities everywhere around America and around the world, I believe that, you know, we're in a battle for the hearts, minds, and souls of people like Major Hassan. There's going to be a lot of people who are going to claim that Major Hassan was not a Muslim. But to me, that's intellectually dishonest, because he did represent an ideology that's very much alive in our Muslim community. We can say that he's a lost sheep, but we cannot say that he was not part of the flock. And in that, I believe we have a responsibility to try to win the hearts and minds of people like Major Hassan, so that we can actually bring them to an interpretation of Islam that says that you can coexist with those who are different from you, and that you can serve in the military, and that you don't do things like Fort Hood.
You go on to write that the story of Hassan at his local mosque is a cautionary tale to all Muslim communities about the consequences when we fail to win the war of ideas in the Muslim world with moderate interpretation of Islam over rigid literal interpretations. You say part of the problem is that many Muslims are clinging to the notion of an ummah, or community, with a capital U, a view that inhibits dissent and encourages blind loyalty. And you say that you feel that this, that sort of liberal or progressive elements are suppressed because then they are viewed as causing dissension within the community.
Yeah, you know, we have this ideological lever in our Muslim community called fitna, which is a term that's used to describe chaos or conflict. And whenever you try to raise your voice inside the community and try to oppose the mainstream ideas because you don't believe that they are representative of the best of Islam, you're accused of fitna. And I know this personally because every time I've tried to raise issues about women's rights in our mosques, try to go into the main halls where women are not allowed, men come, they surround me, and they yell, "You're causing fitna." You know, it isn't a discussion about the issue. It's not a discussion about what's right theologically. It's a discussion about having uniformity. Mm-hmm. And so look at just Major Hassan's PowerPoint presentation. He says in one of his conclusions, God expects full loyalty, promises heaven, and threatens with hell. So that's the politics of ideology then that doesn't allow for critical thinking and dissension in our community, and that's what will fail us.
Imam, let's hear from you.
You know, I think this is a very complex issue. I think that the Muslim community in America is really coming of age. That there is a kind of a discourse that I think may be more proverbial than it is the promise of the future. That today you'll find that there are Muslims who are straight. There are Muslims who are openly gay. There are Muslims who are conservative. There are feminist voices in the Muslim community. There is ethnic diversity. And in that growing community, obviously, there are going to be issues. I would refer you to something that they called Johari's Window. It was by two psychologists, Joe and Harry, who talked about how you see yourself, how others see you in the public arena. Then there's a part of you that you don't see and a part of you that the society at large doesn't see. There's another part that is something that's probably not known by any of us. It's that secret part of us. And then there's the facade. And I think Asma's talking about the facade, the way we would like to perceive ourselves. We would like to say we are a perfect community. Mm-hmm. We are perfectly faithful, that we are the most educated among them, but the reality is we have doctors and we have cab drivers.
I understand that, Imam, but I wanted to talk about...
come on.
But I understand, in part, the reason we called you is this whole issue around Imam Anwar al-Awlaki, and
okay.
He was formerly a staff imam at the community center where you are now working. He's since moved to Yemen. On his mm-hmm. blog, he called Major Hassan a hero. Now, I understand that you know him.
Right.
You were friends with him.
Yeah.
That I understand that you even went on Hajj with him.
Well, we met... On Hajj and spent our Hajj together. But
the only point I wanted to make is that you denounced his comments were made. You and just about every other Muslim leader that I can think of in this country denounced those comments and this conduct once it occurred. I think the question Aswa is asking is before inappropriate or antisocial behavior is experienced, when people are expressing hateful views toward other religions and other peoples and things of that sort, is that behavior discussed and called out within the community?
Well, let's be clear. When Anwar al-Awlaki was at Dar Hijra, he was articulating the same message that I articulate today in Dar Hijra, a very open, a very engaging, a very community wise and contemporary understanding of the faith, even within the framework of its traditionalism. But at the same time, I have to say that the speech that I heard and the only time I ever went to Anwar al-Awlaki's blog was on November the 9th to read this outlandish speech and to say, we would not have tolerated that if he had said that in our mosque before he left in April of 2002. That would not have been acceptable. That would not have been swept under the rug. And I'm a person, I recently spoke at a forum about the treatment of homosexuals at George Washington University, saying, although people may not be ready for it, the reality is that our Islam says that the priority is worshiping God. I think if we're going to talk about hearts and minds, in the case of Nidal, I think that he didn't have his mind.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not a question of his heart. I know his family. I visited their house. I have a fairly good sense, and they have shared with me that they think that he is a person who snapped.
You think it's a psychological issue? Well, Asma, what about that? That it's a psychological problem, and that psychological disorder can be found in any group, and it is found in any religious group.
What concerns me about that kind of analysis is that we don't take responsibility. We don't take responsibility then for the ideology that basically finds a home in a mind that may be vulnerable. And so what happened is that Nidal Hassan's ideology, from the people that I talked to at the mosque in Silver Spring, was obvious for the last 5 years. The conversations that people had with him inside the community were ones in which he espoused an ideology of Islam that is akin to this theology known as Wahhabism and Salafism. It is a rigid, puritanical, very dogmatic interpretation of Islam. We cannot say that he just snapped one day. This was a mind in progress, and he found identity in this ideology.
So,
I just want to say that we have to take responsibility inside our community, and we have to win the mind of somebody like Major Hassan. We have to win his soul. We lost him, and in that, we lost this battle. And I appreciate this dissonance that the Imam is talking about, because until we decide that we can live with a value system inside of ourselves that reflects our external actions, we are going to continue to have individuals like Major Hassan who can't find compatibility between Islam and the West.
I gave you the first word. I'm going to give Imam the last word.
But I want to chime in. The reality is that on some level, I think people have the right. If they want to be conservative in their own personal lives, I think that's fine.
But there's a difference between conservative and racist, isn't there? Or conservative and a bigot and expressing bigotry toward other people, isn't there?
But I'm saying that my own personal feelings about black people, white people, gay people, straight people doesn't give me the right to go into the middle of my workplace and kill my coworker. This has nothing to do with religion. There is nothing about Islam, even if I believe in heaven and hell and a day of judgment, that says that it's okay to kill people.
So is it your view that there's nothing that can be done until someone crosses the line to behavior?
No, I think really we need to have, and I am challenging, a robust discourse about saying that people like Anwar al-Awlaki's speech on his website, we need to send a warning to our young people that that's not acceptable, that bookstores shouldn't post it, that our website shouldn't enlist it. I think that we have to, in the realm of freedom of speech, we have to say that we are going to discipline our own selves. And if there are individuals who speak out that's inappropriate, we need to challenge that.
Unfortunately, we're going to have to leave it there for now, but I'm going to direct people to read your writings at our website. We'll have a posting of the article that you wrote so they can read it in full. Imam Johari Abdul Malik is the director of outreach at the Dar al-Hijra Islamic Center in Falls Church, Virginia, where Nidal Hassan sometimes attended services. Asra Nomani wrote an article for the Daily Beast called Inside the Gunman's Mosque. She talked to Muslim congregants at a Muslim center in Silver Spring, Maryland, another center where Hassan visited. Nomani is also the author of Standing Alone in Mecca, An American Woman's Struggle for the Soul of Islam. They were both kind enough to join us from our studios here in Washington. And we will, of course, have a link to your blog as well, Imam, and we can continue this dialogue online. I thank you both so much for joining us.
All right. Assalamu alaikum.
Thank you, Michelle.
Moving on to another major story, this in the world of media, CNN's Lou Dobbs. The last remaining of the founding anchors at CNN, Dobbs began his professional life as a business reporter and anchor, but evolved into a take-no-prisoners advocate on behalf of certain issues, mainly opposing illegal immigration and also against policy measures he believed disadvantaged the middle class. Dobbs increasingly drew vocal critics who've complained for years that he's a demagogue who plays loose with the facts in support of his political views, but Dobbs has insisted he's merely giving voice to millions of Americans unheard by political leaders. Last night, Dobbs abruptly quit the program with an image of an American flag behind him. Dobbs announced it would be his last broadcast. Jonathan Klein, the president of CNN, said that Dobbs has now decided to carry the banner of advocacy journalism elsewhere. Joining us to talk more about this is Eric Dagans. He's a TV and media critic for the St. Petersburg Times. Eric, welcome. Thank you for talking to us.
Thanks a lot for having me.
Let me just play a short clip of Lou Dobbs' statement on the program, and then you can tell us about what you think.
At this point, I'm considering a number of options and directions, and I assure you I will let you know when I set my course. I truly believe that the major issues of our time include the growth of our middle class, the creation of more jobs, health care, immigration policy, the environment, climate change, and our military involvement, of course, in Afghanistan and Iraq. But each of those issues is, in my opinion, informed by our capacity to demonstrate strong resilience of our now weakened capitalist economy and demonstrate the political will to overcome the lack of true representation in Washington, D.C.
Eric, it sounds to me he isn't really clear about what he's going to do next, but what do you think? Why now?
Well, it's hard to know exactly what's going on because Dobbs and CNN haven't really talked to anybody beyond their statements yet. We're hearing that they're going to CNN is going to announce his replacement perhaps today, and then maybe we'll hear more about their side of it. There seems to have been this growing friction between Lou Dobbs and management at CNN, particularly John Klein, the president of the cable channel, because CNN has been positioning itself as straight down the middle. You know, a honest broker in terms of reporting the news, trying to contrast itself with Fox News, which is, you know, considered to be friendly to the right, and MSNBC, which is considered to be friendly to the left in its prime time, you know, programming, both of those channels. So, so Dobbs, with his show where he would present his opinion and he would speak out very forcefully on issues like illegal immigration and draw a lot of criticism for the way he handled some facts, was something that was increasingly a problem for CNN. And the Associated Press had a story, I think, yesterday that talked about how CNN has a brand that extends beyond the mothership channel to, you know, tons of outlets, CNN International, websites, and the totality of that brand is about trying to be an honest broker about news and information. So if you have somebody as high profile as Dobbs doing what he's doing, that may conflict with the brand, and there's a sense that there was some friction there.
You know, I talked to him in November of 2007. He was promoting one of his books at that time, whatever his latest book was at that time, and I specifically asked him about that, and here's what he had to say. You're obviously very critical of both parties. There are something, 17 people running for president? Is there not one person running now who you think has the skills, the temperament, the character to lead this country properly?
No, ma'am.
Then why don't you run?
Because I don't think that's my role. I'm an advocacy journalist. I think that's what I do best, and that's where I think I serve the American people the best.
So it wasn't a secret that he considered himself an advocate, and he also said he really had no desire to get into the fray, which is, I think, what a number of people were suggesting that he do. I wonder what changed. And I also wonder what changed in terms of that it's the positioning, because CNN allowed him to take that role for a very long time. I mean, he was doing this secretly.
Well, again, as I said, you know, CNN has increasingly sought to brand itself straight down the middle, and this is something that is relatively recent. But there's been conflict, I think, about what Dobbs does. I mean, when Dobbs has correspondence from the channel on his show to talk about things that they're reporting, and he asks them very sort of pointed, opinionated questions, it makes things very difficult for people who are trying to objectively cover the Capitol or objectively cover politics when they go on Dobbs' show and they're sort of pressed to give their opinion about things. So I think there's always been a friction there. Dobbs' show, particularly when you talk to him, was popular and was a ratings high point for the network. So it was hard for them to I think manage him sometimes.
I think that I think there's more to know about this story. Eric Dagans is a TV and media critic for the St. Petersburg Times. He joined us by phone from his office. Eric, thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up, a project reveals the traditions and sounds of Haiti through the voices of its people. More on that in just a few minutes. But first, hilarious, heartbreaking, operatic, brutal. Those are a few of the words that have been used to describe the characters portrayed on screen by entertainer Monique. She became a household name as the leading lady in UPN's The Parkers. She's had a successful stand-up career and two reality TV shows, including a beauty pageant for plus-sized women. Now she's in the headlines with two major projects. She hosts a new late-night talk show on BET and She's playing Mary, the amazingly abusive mother of the title character in the critically acclaimed film Precious, based on the novel Push by Sapphire, which is already generating talk of an Oscar for Monique. And she joins us now. Welcome. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, sis. How you doing?
I'm okay. Well, not as good as you.
I'm sure you are.
You know, on its face, Precious would not seem to be an easy sell. It is about an obese, illiterate, black teenage girl who is being horribly abused, sexually abused by both her parents. Not your typical Friday night date movie, but the movie just opened in 18 theaters across the country. It's grossed almost $2 million, which is on track to be among the top grossing independent films. What do you think is the film's appeal?
It's honesty. It's so honest that you know those people. You know Precious. You know Mary Jones. You may be those people. Every time I've watched it, it makes me go, wow, this is so honest. And I really believe that's why it's so impactful.
Director Lee Daniels was quoted in an interview with the New York Times saying he knew he wanted you for the part of Mary. And when he called you, he said, I had a part for you that is going to, quote, mess up your career. You're going to lose your world, your audience, your standing in the BET community. And you are quoted as saying you did not hesitate. Why not?
Number one, the audience is very intelligent and they know the difference. And number two, I was so excited to be able to be a part of telling this amazing story. And a young lady said to me earlier today, she said, you know, Monique, the movie is so heartbreaking. And I said, you're absolutely right, but it's also heart healing.
Well, let me just give people a little sense of what it is that we're talking about. You play Mary, as we said, she is the mother of Precious, and she abuses her child not just verbally and physically, but also, and I'm not sure this is something that we've seen on film in this country before, she's a mother who sexually is abusing her daughter. And I just want to play a short clip. In this scene, you are being confronted by Mariah Carey, who plays Precious's social worker, and she's confronting you about why you allowed the husband to abuse Precious, and here it is.
And I don't want you to sit there and judge me, Miss Weiss.
You shut up and you let him abuse your daughter.
I did not want him to abuse my daughter. I did not
but
want him to hurt her.
But you allowed him to
I did not want
her.
Him to do nothing to her. So those things that she told you did to her, who else was going to love me? Hmm? Who was going to make me feel good?
How did you get into the mind of Mary?
You know, Mary Jones was mentally ill, and she wasn't the type of mental illness that you see in a straitjacket in an institution. She was mentally ill and being your next-door neighbor. And I knew Mary Jones. That character, for me, was my brother, my oldest brother, Gerald. So when Mr. Daniel said action, that's who I became.
I was going to mention that you have disclosed that you also were a victim of sexual abuse growing up by your brother. But mm-hmm. I still want to ask if that was hard for you to transition from being the victim to the victimizer. You had to get into that mindset.
You know what, Michelle, I'm always very careful when I answer this question because I never want to sound vain. But no, it wasn't hard because we're entertainers. So when Mr. Daniels told me who this character was, that's who I had to become every time he said action. Then the moment he said cut, I was Monique. My husband and I talked before we started filming, and he said, Mama, leave it on the floor. Every time he says cut, leave it right there. And that's what we did.
If you're just joining us, this is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin, and I'm visiting with Monique. We're talking about a film performance that has already won a special prize at the Cannes Film Festival, and we're going to talk about her new late-night talk show. Just one more question about the movie before we go. Precious is very, very big. I mean, she's obese. It's part of the character. And you've been very outspoken about representing for large women, about size acceptance, about all those things. And I'm just wondering, how did you square up your... Are you kind of repositioning yourself on this issue? What is it? What do you want to say about that?
As we can see, eating that food all the time can be very damaging. So for me, as a big person, and at one time at 262 pounds, and now I'm down to 217 pounds, what I do say is be smart.
On a very different note, you have a new talk show.
Yeah.
On BET. Let's play a short clip.
Because this is Black Entertainment Television.
BET!
Okay, come on. We get an opportunity to talk to us. And where's my camera to America? I want to talk directly to my brothers and sisters in America. If you are a beautician, listen to me clearly. If you do hair, my sisters or my brothers, your hair should always be done.
Break it down. Let it down. Preach on about that. I'm going to bear that in mind. So don't go to a beautician who's wearing a hat, huh?
Don't do it.
So tell me why you wanted to do this show, and are you having fun so far? You just started.
I am having the time of my life. And just for me, as a person that watches television, I want to watch something that makes me feel good. I want to watch something where they have a great time. They laugh, they dance, they party, they uplift, they love. That's what I want to watch.
Any guests that you want to tell us about?
You know what? Because everybody keeps saying to me, Monique, who's your dream guest? Everybody that sat on that sofa has been my dream guest because I'm in the midst of my dream.
Monique's new talk show airs on BET weeknights at 11 p.m. You'll want to check your local listings, of course. Her new movie, Precious, is open in select theaters nationwide, and she joined us by phone, I think, from your studio where you're taping your...
Atlanta, uh-huh.
From your studio where you're taping your program. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, sister.
And finally, a rediscovered recording project brings voices from Haiti's past back to life. The late Alan Lomax learned his trade as a folklorist by working with his father, John Lomax, recording the field songs of black sharecroppers in the American South. In 1936, at the age of 21, Alan was dispatched to Haiti by the Library of Congress, his mission to record and film the music and culture of the Haitian people. In little more than a year, Lomax and his newlywed wife, Elizabeth, made some 1,500 recordings, capturing rare music and sounds across the country. Here's a sample. The collection is now being released as a 10-disc box set, along with Lomax's journal and other artifacts from the expedition. Joining us now to tell us more from Toronto is Gage Averill. He's an ethnomusicologist and a professor at the University of Toronto. He was the project's curator. And in New York, we're pleased to welcome Ellen Harold, Alan Lomax's niece, who also worked on the project. Welcome to you both.
Good. Thanks, Michelle. Nice to be here.
So, Professor Averill, this project was started in 1936. What took so long to hear these recordings?
I could describe when I first encountered this, and this was in interacting with Alan's daughter, Anna Lomax Wood, who was running the archive. And she asked if I'd be willing to work on this project and curate it. And I said, what recordings? And I was a specialist in Haitian music, so I had no idea that there were these 1,500 recordings sitting in the vaults at the Library of Congress. And I think that was true. They were just unknown. Alan hadn't written very much about them in his time, and so they were literally sitting in stacks covered by cardboard covers all that time.
Alan, can you tell us a little bit more about what Alan Lomax and Elizabeth Lomax's conditions were working in Haiti at that time? It was a pretty tumultuous time in the island's history, as I recall.
Well, I think it was a time of hopefulness because the Marines had just withdrawn and they had left a representative government there, and there was a great interest among Haitians in their African heritage. And as far as their conditions, Alan arrived there, and of course he was very lonely and immediately caught all kinds of fevers. And his fiance, Elizabeth, who was then 19, arrived somewhere in early February. And she actually made the films that are included in the box.
Do you happen to know what the process was that they used to record this material? I'm thinking now, you know, we could wander around in something that would be the size of a credit card, you know?
Yeah.
Well, I'm thinking it wasn't like that then.
Imagine a very large box weighing 55 pounds, and it had two turntables on the top, and it would record directly onto 10 or 12-inch aluminum discs with a stylus. So he'd sit there recording with a disc playing, and it would scratch or etch the sound into the disc. So in addition to carrying the 55 pounds of recording device, he also had to carry stacks and stacks of aluminum discs, because each of these recordings could be just as little as 3 or 5 minutes. So there was a lot of weight to carry around.
Ellen, can I ask one other thing? I understand that he was sick a lot when he was there. Is that true? So in addition to lugging around all this equipment, he was sick a lot.
They were sick, and they went out into northern part of Haiti, and they were paying people, you know, a small sum when they could to record, and so people started coming and camping out in their house in order to play for them. And because they were sick, they couldn't get rid of them. It was really quite a dilemma at times.
Oh, dear. I'll think next time I complain about the hotel accommodations on an assignment. Ellen, you mentioned that Ellen and Elizabeth arrived there after the Marines had left. The U.S. Marines had occupied the country from 1915 to 1934, and he's arriving just a couple of years after the Marines had left. How did people respond to this couple wandering around with this stuff wanting to record their music?
Well, I think they were delighted that someone wanted to record their music.
Let's play a recording and then you can tell us some more about it. Here it is.
This is called Merci Papa Vincent, which means thank you, Father Vincent. And it's for that president, the first president of Haiti following the American invasion. And this was a jazz band playing at an elite club on Christmas Eve.
I was going to say, it sounds like a jazz that Americans would have heard. Do you think that there was a cross-influence, as it were Americans hearing Haitian music and were Haitians hearing American music at that time?
The Americans stationed in Haiti during the occupation were hearing Haitian music, and the Haitian musicians were also hearing jazz and dance band music from them, and turning it around into like local merengue jazz fusions. So it was quite an active cross-fertilization at the time.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm speaking with Professor Gage Averill and Ellen Harold about the great folklorist Alan Lomax and his time in Haiti. Professor Averill, who do you think will appreciate this?
Well, there are, as we've seen in the past 30 years, a growing number of people all over the world interested in kind of encountering new sounds. This is going to be quite a new repertory for people. I mean, there's everything in this from Boy Scout songs of the 1930s to old Mardi Gras and carnival songs that are topical. So these are dealing with the issues in the 1930s. So there's people who love Caribbean music who will find a great deal in this. I think it's going to have an enormous effect on people interested in issues of cultural equity and cross-cultural encounters around the world.
Ellen, you mentioned that some of the religious music of voodoo ceremonial music was recorded. I'm going to play a short clip, and hopefully you can tell us a little bit more about it. What can you tell us about this song?
I can tell you that from the diary that Alan said that he really wasn't that focused on ethnography and explaining the theology of voodoo, but that he did want to document the sound of it.
That's what separated Alan from all the other people working in the country, is that his methodology was focused on the sound recordings, right? So other people were describing them or notating them or talking about the context, but Alan left this archive. In this case, what you're hearing was recorded at the first voodoo ceremony ever recorded, more or less in its entirety. So this was a ceremony in Pompoudet for what they call breaking the cakes or sharing the cake. And this is a song for Dambala, who's a deity associated with snakes. And the song simply says, Dambala wedo tokon kulev, or Dambala wedo, which is the name of the deity, the sign of the snake.
These recordings are so old, and yet they're sort of a discovery, really, kind of a new discovery. They're important to the Library of Congress, but also, I would think, to the people of Haiti. What do you think we will find in these recordings? Ellen, why don't you start?
Well, I think it's going to be a wonderful thing for the Haitian people, because the Association for Cultural Equity had an ongoing repatriation project to make these available in Haiti. And Kimberly Green of the Green Foundation has said that preservation to support cultural identity is an integral part of poverty mitigation.
Really? Why?
Well, because when people hear and know their own past, it often is very empowering. Alan certainly found this when he recorded people. He would play it back to them, and they would be delighted.
You think that perhaps there are, say, children growing up in Haiti who would never have heard maybe the music of their forebears?
Sure. Not just children, but many of the elders that we consulted with and we'd call about this material hadn't heard this maybe since the time of their early youth or heard about some of this music from their parents. I remember I was asked to introduce Catherine Dunham, this sort of very well-known African-American dancer who had been in Haiti just before Ellen. And I was up on stage, and I was about to introduce her, and I looked down at my computer, and I remembered I have, you know, Ellen's 1,500 recordings, including about 300 that were made with friends of Catherine Dunham in the same peristyle or the same temple that she used to visit. I went over to her and I said, "Miss Dunham, would you mind if I played, you know, old friends, Taline Marseille?" And she was thunderstruck. She had never heard any of this and knew that it existed, and got up to speak afterwards in tears, talking about how I had in my computer a govi, or a spirit repository, which is a notion from Haitian voodoo. And so all along, that kind of notion that we are in some ways stewards and guardians of all this cultural richness and personal investment was a real motivating factor to try to get this out and to do the job.
Gage Averill is the curator of the newly released 10-CD box set titled Alan Lomax in Haiti. He joined us from the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation studios in Toronto. We were also pleased to be joined by Ellen Harold. She is Alan Lomax's niece, and she also worked on the project, and she joined us from our bureau in New York. Thank you both so much for speaking with
us. Jill, thanks so much.
And that's our program for today. I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Let's talk more tomorrow.